sahanavavatu, sahano bhunaktu, sahaviryam karavavahai, tejasvinavadhitamastu mavidvishavahai, Jaya Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhara Srivasadi Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare
In his definition, Srila Rupa Goswami uses the word Krishnanu Shilanam. The purport is that Swayam Bhagavan Sri Krishna is the ultimate objective, objective indicated by the term Kevala Bhakti. The word Bhakti is also used for Narayana and other expansions of Krishna, but it is only Krishna who can reciprocate with the complete sentiments of Bhakti, because Krishna has those four qualities that are not manifest in the personality of Narayana. So when we say the complete sentiments of bhakti, means that the Narayana is reciprocating with his devotees on the platform of devotion, and it is perfect and complete in itself, but the absolute end, or not, let's say, the absolute extent that devotion can be manifested in all its very, very subtle and especially the sweet elements, that one won't find in Narayana, one will only find in Krishna. Right? Does that make sense? Yes.
What I have like an area of doubt.
An area of doubt.
Since the topic will be also discussed in this chapter, I think... Everybody has some inherent rasa.
Everyone has an inherent rasa.
Does it also contain the object of this rasa? That, for example, what will happen if a devotee who is inherently Vishnu Bhakta will approach our line, which is based on nectar of devotion and devotion to Krishna? Mm-hmm.
The point is the information that's there is not a problem for anyone. The science of devotion is just as valid in any of the four sampradayas, so that doesn't make any difference. The point is that if the taste is there, then one will remain. If that's just one in that one. Now, if inherently he's a devotee of Vishnu, he'll either not come to this line, or, you know, our teachings would just enhance his appreciation of, you know, his devotion to Vishnu. So there's no problem. You had same question.
Not quite. So it says the word bhakti is also used for Narayana and other expansions of Krishna. Does this mean that bhakti in itself is considered like an expansion of Krishna? And
then, well, bhakti is an energy.
Yeah.
So it'll naturally, but the point is it will be matched with, just like when Krishna's there, because he is the full manifestation of Godhead, therefore the Sarup Shakti is the full manifestation of energy. Mm. Then when he expands, you know, so there's less qualities being manifest, whereas we're talking about less qualities and unlimited, so, you know, then that means the internal potency, when it expands to match that, also is manifesting those few less. So that means those areas that are not less aren't part of the reciprocation. That doesn't make it any less perfect, you know, or any less complete. It just means that Krishna is most perfect. Like it says, Vishnu is perfect. You know, Dwarka is perfect. Mathura is more perfect. Vrindavan's most perfect. So it just means those sentiments aren't being exchanged or not being exchanged in that intimacy or elements like that. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Because the element of intimacy is not there. Because in Vishnu, the element of the on reverence, that servitorship, it will limit the how you say, what it does is it limits the sense of possession. Right? It means we belong to Vishnu and he's our Lord, but it's formal. Right? But a friend is my friend, you know, so I can do what I want with him. You know, he's sleeping, I can wake him up because we're going to go do something or like that. But you don't do that with Vishnu. You know, with someone who's a master, you don't do that. Does that make sense? So it just becomes more and more intimate. Parentals even more, conjugals even more. So you don't see. So then one could say, but then Krishna and Dwarka, you have all those five rasas, but the conjugal there being the svakya, then it will also have some limitation like that, because there's the sense of ownership, but there's the sense of rightful ownership. So the tendency is you will deal with it. There's always time. So if it doesn't happen now, later. You know what I'm saying? So that sense of urgency is not there. But in Parakya, there's urgency because you don't know how long will be the interaction. It means you may plan it'll be a long time, but at any time, somebody will walk in, and then that's it. You know, while a queen, if Rukmini is with Krishna, and someone walks in, what's the problem? You understand? It may adjust the presentation, but it's not going to. But the other one, it's just, it doesn't exist. You know what I'm saying? So there's always that greater amount of that intimacy in those things. So in that, you can manifest subtle things that you wouldn't see otherwise. You know, just like the devotees were actually surprised, not mean pleasantly surprised, very surprised that on Hara Panchami, Lakshmi came out and so ferociously came and, you know, attacked, you know, Jagannath's, you know, place of stay in Vrindavan, you know, and harassed his pujaris and, you know, displayed so much anger, and then when he came back, you know, locks him out for 3 days. Because she just doesn't do that. So that's a rare manifestation. You know, everyone appreciates, but it's, you know, but in Vrindavan, that's pretty standard. You know, because for Lakshmi, who's the competition? There isn't any. Right? But, you know, the gopis, how many are there? Right? Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Like that. Because in Dwarka, there's 16,108 queens, but Krishna manifests with each one of them. So when he walks into the palace, they think they're alone with Krishna. Right? But with the gopis, it's not that. There's one Krishna, and then, you know, there's, you know, 16,000 of them trying to get him to come to their place. Does that make sense? So you have details, fine details. The main points and, you know, sub points are all there, but these finer points that come up from that intimacy because of possession, that you won't find in these other expansions. Does that make sense? So therefore, that's why it says the complete sentiments. It doesn't say the sentiments of bhakti. There's no bhakti. No, there's great bhakti and there's great. And it'll be appreciated. We'll even appreciate it because devotion is devotion. It's just that of devotion, then the devotion in Vrindavan, we consider, you know, that's where our taste is. Does that make sense?
Yeah, like how many parameters there are, something like that.
Yeah.
When we say Kevala Bhakti uses chop to indicate bhakti towards Krishna, and especially Raghunatha Bhakti, Rupa Goswami defines it in Bhakti-rasamrita more general.
Kevala can be general, but here he's made it clear that it's Krishnanushilanam. So in this definition, he's talking about the pure, unalloyed devotion to Krishna. right? But you will have, you know, in Vishnu Bhakti, you'll have Kevala Bhakti, but it'll be in the context of Vishnu. Does that make sense? So Kevala here means pure Bhakti, right? It's not mixed with anything. So that would mean there's no karma and no jnana, right? But for us, then it indicates pure unalloyed, means there's not even an interest in liberation or other aspects like that. So it's just being brought to the level of the Braja Bhakti, because there, then it's 100% only for Krishna. In other realms, is that it's transcendental, but there's that the pleasure of being involved in it, meaning that it's your, because you're liberated, it's your position to be happy. So it will be noticed. But in Vrindavan, they don't bother noticing it, so technically they're even more happy. Does that make sense? Yeah. So here in this definition, we're talking about pure unalloyed devotion to Krishna. But he's not saying that that doesn't mean that there's no devotion when you're dealing with another form of Krishna. It's just that you can manifest the maximum amount of exchange, varieties of exchange, or completeness of exchange with Krishna only. That makes sense? Yeah? You had something? No. Yeah?
I'm sorry. I will ask further on this. But this message, Chris, and I would say imposition, that like in Istan, everybody is thinking that I am worshipping Krishna. And what if somebody is...
And we are.
We are, yes. But what if somebody is inherently connected to another form of the Lord?
And you're worried about that. You're worried that it'll be unjust that someone who is actually inherently a devotee of Vishnu is, you know, unnecessarily forced to worship, you know, the sweetest, most form of, you know, manifestation of the personality of Godhead, and this will be some kind of transcendental abuse. So we set up an office. You know, give out forms. Do you feel that you're being pressured into worshiping Krishna when you'd actually rather be worshiping, you know, Krishna Garba?
At some point there will be a change of mentality.
The Vaikuntha, the worshippers in Vaikuntha, it's not that they have a problem with Krishna's pastimes in Vrindavan and Krishna. They just see it that Krishna is an expansion of Vishnu. So they may even prefer his Vrindavan pastimes. So they always worship Vishnu in his Vrindavan pastimes. Like in the Sri Sampradaya amongst the, means the Alwars, means their previous acharyas, they all wrote songs. And so these songs are a major aspect of their, you know, their study, their practice, all these different things. Does that make sense? So just as we have the songs in our Bharacharyas, then they have the songs of theirs. So of the three of those Alwars, 3 out of 12 wrote songs about Krishna and Vrindavan. And one of them, Andal, exclusively only wrote about Krishna and Vrindavan. Didn't write about anything else. So they don't have a problem. The difference is they think Krishna, Vishnu is so wonderful that he has all these varieties of pastimes, that he also has these wonderful, sweet pastimes in Vrindavan. Does that make sense? So they won't have a problem. Okay? So we can close the office. Yes, yes. Okay? That makes sense? So therefore, because we don't have any problem, you know, talking about Vishnu, so they have no problem talking about Krishna. Just we understand Krishna is the original. And they are, you know, feeling that Vishnu is the original. You have to feel Vishnu is the original to deal with awe and reverence. Right? Because otherwise, then that awe and reverence is based on what is the greatest. And if Krishna is greater, then why would they be worshipping Vishnu? You understand? So it's inherent that they have to think like that. You know, just like I say, every mother feels her child has descended from the heavenly planets. At least tell me on a good day.
Does that mean we're constitutionally related to a certain form of Vishnu? Some are considered related to Krishna, some to Vishnu, some to...
That is there, but that's not what's important. The point is that you're in the material world and drowning in the ocean, so it doesn't matter who you are in the spiritual world, you're still drowning. So it only has serious meaning when you're out of the water and on the boat. And so when you're on the boat, you're liberated. And if you're liberated, then it's not an issue. It's not a worry. Well, what if this? What if that?
You're just attracted to whatever you're attracted to.
Yeah, that's all. You know what I'm saying?
Is that Dorjam Puryam? Is that the peak of the mountain? And we're standing across the different levels, but towards, you know, you may be at the bottom of the mountain.
Okay.
So for us looking up to the top of the mountain, the difference between the top, but then there's actually the peak that we can't perceive. So it's all, you know, kind of like that. But it's all the top of the mountain, but there may be variations between the top and the actual peak of the
mountain. So the point is developing this bhakti. So unless one has that, one won't be going to Vaikuntha or Vrindavan. So we should focus on this aspect. Does that make sense? Because otherwise all these what ifs, you know, that's, it's a problem. See, because one can naturally, if need be, there one can change rasa and move up. Generally one won't move down, but one will move up. Can. But it's not required. Like Murari Gupta, he was quite happy worshipping Lord Chaitanya and taking part in the Sankirtan pastimes, but he would see all this as connected to Ram. Like that. So when they tried to switch him to Radha and Krishna, he just couldn't do it. He tried, but it just doesn't work. So the point is it, don't worry about it.
It has its other side. Others will.
It has its other side. What is this other side?
That others will propound like the absoluteness of that everybody should accept this and accept this as their Swarupa already.
And who do you know sits around talking about Swarupa?
There are some persons around Vrindavan.
And so then one avoids them. In other words, if they publicly talk about your sarupa and this and that, then you can know for certain that is an assembly you absolutely don't need to go to. Give an example. Married women, if they're sitting around, there's younger girls and all that there, will they talk about intimate relations with men? Wouldn't have a clue. Okay. No. Okay? So, it's just they don't do it. Now, let's say someone who's, you know, older, they're engaged. So in talking with others who are engaged, they may talk a little bit about like this or the married one like this. But also, if there's others there, it's known maybe they're engaged, but they won't talk about it. Like if the little, you know, 12-year-old girl goes, wow, how is he like? You know, they're not going to talk about it. You understand? It's the teenagers who will talk about it because it's new. It's something they just think about. So they'll talk about it. You understand? Because they don't discriminate. They'll talk anywhere and this and that. So that's how you understand. Like you don't see Prabhupada Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati talking. You don't see the Nitya Siddhas sitting around and talking that stuff. Why? Because it doesn't matter. Does that make sense? It just absolutely doesn't matter. Because it won't mean anything anyway. So that's why we're saying, what if? It's not real. We're not going, in this situation, this is there, so how do we deal with that? because it's totally and absolutely theoretical. Because we have no understanding of it, and therefore these doubts can come up, and it's just mathematics. You could do this. You know, what if they come in and you know, they're actually in the spiritual world a bat, and so they should be hanging upside down, but we demand that they stand on their feet because otherwise socially it looks weird. Will they feel, you know, some problem? You know what I'm saying? So you get all these different, it's, what ifs are not important. I mean, they're great for causing discussions and that, like we've been on this for the last 15 minutes, but you understand that they're not actually very important because, in other words, keep it to the relevance of where you're at now and understanding the goal. But this is like, you know, unless you're really worried that you're really, you know, interested in the Vaikuntha Murti, then it's not relevant to you. You know what I'm saying? The point is that it's understood that worship of Krishna will be the highest. So even within the Vaikuntha realm, they'll consider it the sweetest. They don't say it's the highest, but they say it's the sweetest. The pastimes and majesty and all these different things, they'll say Krishna's path are the sweetest. That's agreed. And they have no problem with it. They'll always talk about them and, you know, sing songs. So they don't have any problem with us coming around because, you know, to them it's, you know, these are the Vrindavan guys, you know. Does that make sense? So it's, that's all. So it's not a problem. Vaishnavas don't have a problem. Right? That's the, it means the, in touch with Vivek, Bhaktivinoda Thakur makes the point that in the material world, then there's so many varieties of mentalities and perceptions. But in the spiritual world, there's only one. And that the Lord is the Supreme, we're His servant, and you worship Him through devotion. And so the variety of devotion that's there, everybody appreciates the other's devotion. Like that. Does that make sense? You know, Narad Muni is a Vaikuntha man. But he's quite happy going to Dwarka and Vrindavan, all these things. It's all because it's all about Krishna. Does that make sense? And, if someone's talking that you have a Sarup and this and that, that's all right. But if they're talking about you have to act within it, that's where the Sahaja comes in. Because unless you're liberated, there is no ifs, no ands, and no buts that you can function within your sarup. Other than sarup meaning I'm servant. That's the difference. Raganuga means you understand where you have an idea that I want to serve in this way, but you don't meditate on you serving. Because you have to be there, you have to do the service in a spiritual body. What are you going to meditate on? You don't even know. So therefore, any meditation means you're putting the material body in the spiritual pastimes. That's called sahaja. You know, it's just easy. Right? Actual raganu is you are inspired thinking about what those who are in the pastimes are doing. Does that make sense? So you remember the pastimes. It doesn't change. So this idea is, no, we change our sadhana and we do things differently. No, it's exactly the same. Because it's vaidhi sadhana bhakti. It's sadhana bhakti. Right? So then you'll have vaidhi and raganuga. One is that you're focusing more on the rules. The other is the rules are natural for you and you're focusing on, you know, the exchanges or elements that are there in following the rules. This idea also that raganuga means you don't follow the rules, that's also a misnomer. That's also the sahajya element. So that's what Prabhupada talks. He constantly uses raganuga bhakti, spontaneous. He doesn't have a problem with that. He has a problem with the materially conceived idea of raganuga. Does that make sense? That's why there's only one example given for Raganuga Bhakti. That is the wife with the parama. You don't hear of another example. So, and the example is she does her duties even more nicely. What does that mean? I mean, she follows the rules better than a wife who doesn't have a parama. Right? Does that make sense? In other words, the wife who doesn't have a parama, if she feels like it, she does everything. If she doesn't feel like it, she may drop a few things. Right? Does that make sense? So the performance of sadhana bhakti may not be as exacting. but the wife of the paramour, then to hide the fact that she has one, she does all her duties so perfectly that no one would guess. That means a Raganuga Sadhaka, his Vaidhi Bhakti, or his performance of what we call Vaidhi Bhakti, will be better than the Vaidhi Sadhaka. So this idea is that, oh, we drop all that. This is all sahaja. This is all misunderstanding. Does that make sense? Yeah, because if you think about it, what would you drop? You know, making 7 offerings a day at the temple, or not changing his clothes, or not being clean, you know, not being God conscious, not singing songs, not making nice offerings. No, what would you drop that would enhance the rasa and therefore give Krishna more pleasure? Does that make sense? So that's the point, is that they don't know what they're talking about. The rule doesn't, you're not doing it because it's the rule. That's Vaidhi. Because the rule says. So they say, well, you know, because, you know, the scriptures say that Raganuga Bhakti is the highest, so, you know, we should be involved in that. And, you know, so therefore, you know, we have to approach, you know, an advanced person who knows this. We have to hear from him about this. We have to always absorb ourselves in those pastimes. Or that.
That's Vaidhi.
That's all Vaidhi. Every last word of that. And so what you generally hear in the name of Raganuga is Vaidhi. Because if it was Raganuga, there's a good chance you wouldn't be hearing about it. I see. Yes. Spontaneity. Does this make sense? In other words, means the principles of what Raganuga is, that can be discussed openly. But the practice of it, one's personal practice, that's not discussed openly. It just doesn't have. So if you hear it being discussed openly, In a broad assembly, that means there's something wrong. You know what I'm saying? You know, the wife of the paramour, who would she talk to about her paramour? Basically nobody, unless it's someone else who's very close, or, you know, someone who has the same kind of situation, or someone who's a very dear friend. They're not going to talk about it openly. It's just not done. So these examples are given because they match. They actually work. Because here, if we're dealing with rag, we're not dealing with rules, we're dealing with moods. And so the mood is one doesn't share these things. Does that make sense? Okay. Although the absolute truth is one, it is manifest in 3 forms: Brahma Tattva, Paramatma Tattva, and Bhagavat Tattva. Those who try to realize the absolute truth by the cultivation of jnana cannot advance beyond the concept of Brahma Tattva. The variegated aspect of transcendence, which lies much deeper, is not realized. One can be protected from the anartha of impersonalism only if he meets a self-realized Vaishnava guru. So it means if you're using only jnana, you can't get past Brahman, because you're not in the path of jnana. You're not dealing with emotions, feelings, relationships, anything. You can see how it functions, but that's all the more it'll be appreciated. So the Vaishnava guru, he can show how that's there, and that's non-different from Krishna, but the aspects and the energies of that one seeing, the perception of the varieties of Brahman, that is coming from the person. Right? And they're the natural, counterpart to the person. They're just the unmanifest element. Let's say someone's happy. Okay? I say, this devotee's happy. Okay? So, how do we know?
He smiles, symptoms.
He smiles, so it's a symptom. So it's a manifestation. So Brahman means it's unmanifest. Doesn't mean it doesn't have qualities. That's why when they say it's nirgun, there's no such thing. Because they'll say it's, you know, all one, it's, you know, all pervading. All pervading is a quality.
Eternal.
These are qualities. But they only accept certain ones of them. but there's unlimited qualities. But when they manifest, that's what they're. So here is manifest in the material phenomena, right? Then you have manifest in the spiritual phenomena. And then you have the original person himself.
So then what about Prakriti? Brahman can be realized by Gyan. I mean, Gyan can only bring you up to Brahman.
Yes.
And Bhakti is revealed by the devotee. What about Paramatma? How can he be contacted?
There is the yogis, because they'll appreciate the personal aspect. Well, the Gyan, because there you're using the Astanga Yoga. Right? Because you're using the mind. Because Gyan doesn't use the mind. It uses the intelligence. Of course, they mentally speculate, but they've already, the intelligence establishes that this is what's the value. And so then the mind will choose from the various, permutations that are there in trying to find, an application to that knowledge, to the situation. But the emotions and the feelings about it, right, that's not what's important.
So Dhyan will bring Paramatma.
Dhyan will bring, but it'll be limited there. Like that. Does that make sense? Because then they're only seeing that he's controlling the world and doing those things. But what he would rather see done and all that, that takes it to Bhagavan. Right? He means, Paramatma, you want to do something, if you have the piety to do it, you can do it. Even if it's wrong. You know what I'm saying? Does that make sense? You have been... you deal with money... Yeah, it means like you want to do something right or wrong. If you have the credits that will apply there, then Paramatma will arrange it. But it's not his desire. It's your desire. Right? So that's why just with a spark of his energy, he takes care of this. It doesn't catch his interest. But Bhagavan means what is his interest, what he thinks is important.
So that's why the mystic city, now you have the piety that lets you access them, but it's for your...
Yeah, it's for yours. But even you see the Lord, it's still because you just want to see the absolute truth, or you want to get something from, or like that. But if on seeing, then you surrender... Then you take up bhakti. But, if you want to wait 60,000 years, then, hey, we're not going to complain. But, you know what I'm saying? So it's... Those who pursue the path of yoga realize only the all-pervading Paramatmavada. Thus, they cannot attain the realization of Shuddha Bhagavat Tattva. In this process, there are a few attributes of bhakti, but it is not shuddha bhakti. Generally, religious principles in this world, which pass for Bhagavad Dharma, are all merely yoga processes which strive for realization of the Paramatma feature. We cannot expect that in the end, all of them will ultimately lead us to Bhagavad Dharma. Because the religious principles in this world, then they're dealing with the situations of the world and our situation in them. And we're in that situation because of our previous acts, our karma. Right? So it's our conditioning that places. So we're trying to take our conditioning and apply it into the elements of the world. Right? In a proper way, in a religious way. So even if it's connected to the Lord, it's still, the exchange is restricted by that particular dharma. Does this make sense? Say, you're being honest in the situation. So then you're restricted to only exchange through that element of honesty, and that means then you have to follow the rules that Krishna gives about honesty. Otherwise, how are you dealing with the master of the rules and yourself as the servant of the rules? You know what I'm saying? So God defines, as we were reading in the Ishvapanishad, that the first thing is the Shastra, right? The Praman, what is the evidence. So the Shastra defines what God thinks is the proper way of doing things. So whatever is your conditioning, there's some way that you can be involved in your interaction in the material nature that is based on... its actual inherent nature according to God's laws. Right? It means the situation has its own nature. We think, I'm in a situation, I'll do with the situation as I like, but you can't. Does that make sense? You're falling out of an airplane, you can't decide you're going to walk over to, you know, the local store and pick something up for lunch. You know, you're not going to, you're going to fall. You're not going to walk this way. You know what I'm saying? So, the situation has its inherent nature. Due to illusion, we don't understand that or accept it. So, that situation is there because it, the situation is defined by God's laws. We're in that situation because of God's laws, because of our previous actions and the laws that apply to our actions. Therefore, we're in that situation. But we're so foolish we think, I will control this situation. No, we can be assistant in that situation. Now, if we see it in connection with the Lord, then we're dealing with the superior energy. And so we'll follow the laws and it'll be devotional. Or we may be pious, we accept the Shastra, so we follow the laws according to that situation. And therefore we'll get piety and material benefit from it. Or we may decide, I'm going to do whatever I like in this and try to force what I want out of it. And but you can even only force what you want out of it if there's a little aspect of that in that situation. But it will be temporary, because that's not the situation for it. You know what I'm saying? Just like, let's say you're at a funeral, right? Now everybody's kind of in one mood, but let's say you've just come up with this great business idea, you know, and your friend's there, and, you know, unfortunately it is his mom in the casket there. And so then you start, you do have the opportunity there, because you're standing next to him, and he's not talking. So you could start talking about, wow, this great idea, you know, we could do this and that, and, you know, we could, you know, start these cruises and people could really enjoy themselves and we really go out, you know. He doesn't want to hear it. So you've said it, and so I want to say this to him, you've said it, but it gets no real benefit. Does that make sense? So you can force the issue. You know, when you want something, you can do it illegally, but it's not going to give anything very satisfactory. And it'll tend to create situations in the future that have less and less of this opportunity. Right? Next time, you know, when his father dies, he'll make sure you're in the back. You know. Or he won't even invite you, right? You know, so. Does that make sense?
So you still need some pious benefits. Be impious.
Yeah, of course. I mean, someone who's sincerely, successfully impious, they have a lot of piety there to do that. But because they're applying their piety in an impious way, it will be lost. So in the future, then they won't have any of that. You know, so what we call is, the one class of, like, Western ideal, you know, the tycoon who flies around in every city and, you know, does all of whatever he does and stays in the hotels and goes out to the big disco or whatever he does like this and everything's nonsense. That's only because there's previous piety, but because he's applying it like this in his next life, you know, he won't be able to get, you know, a motel, you know, let alone a 5-star, right? You know what I'm saying? It just won't happen. He won't get any facility. Does that make sense? So that's the thing, is when we're looking at it, no, but they're not following the Vedas and they're successful. No, they're only successful because of the leftover piety from previous lifetimes of following the Vedic. There's no question of getting any piety without following God's laws. There's no question. Now, with unknowingly you follow a law, you get benefit. You know what I'm saying? You don't know that it's Vedic, but, you know, you... Like, let's say, there's you're walking down the street, and there is a priest there, and he gets attacked by some hoodlums, and you chase them off. Then means in the Vedas it mentions that if you protect the Brahmin, you know, that's the best thing that a shooter could ever do, right? And so, even if he's killed in the process, he will be immediately elevated to the heavenly planets. He's done nothing else other than that. So the person does that, he'll be elevated. He doesn't know all that, but it's there. But he has some of that piety left over that he's able to do. But he's unconscious, doesn't know what's going on. So his application of his pious credits are unscientific. So he can't really make the best out of what he has. Does that make sense? So this idea is that we either criticize, oh, they're all just nonsense. No, the nonsense is they're not Krishna conscious. It's not nonsense that they have facility. But if they're Krishna conscious, they use their facility differently. And it's not that, well, look at them, they have facility and we're doing this, and so if we do what they do, then we'll get facility. No, that doesn't work either, because if you want to go for mundane, unless you have the pious credits, and if you really want to know, just rewind back to the day before you joined. What did you have? You know? So if you were the big tycoon, yeah, you can go back to that. If you weren't, you know, if you were the Arta or Artarti, then good luck. Does that make sense? Or if you want to convert your devotional credits into material piety, you can do that also, but that's kind of stupid. Yes?
The one that would chase the Brahmana as sort of unknowingly followed Vedic principles, they will actually get more benefit than someone that's doing things through piety because they're not doing it for themselves, whereas the ones...
No. If you know that you should protect and you step up and do it, then you're doing it in knowledge. The other one is doing it because, you know, they're nice or no one should bother anybody, or they have that sentiment, that's our priest, you're not going to bother. If anyone's going to beat our priest, I'm going to do it, not you. You know, so it's like, you know, you're from the next block, you know, so it's, you know what I'm saying?
I know, but if the ones that say, yeah, I know that's our priest, but hey, I'm going to do this and then I'm going to end up with someone.
Of course, if you're thinking for about the result, that's less, but that's not based on knowledge. That's based on the mentality that I'm going to get the benefit. But even if they think I'm going to get the benefit, you still get the benefit. You just won't get maybe quite as much, but you still get the benefit. You know what I'm saying? You know, it's just like the person comes along and knows that if they smile and say certain things and they'll get you in a certain mood and they can get something done. And it's really obvious that they're doing it, but it still works. You know what I'm saying? But if they did it without, just naturally, it would get more. You know, so it's not that it won't work. The piety always works. But the point is it's being made, is piety still keeps you in the material world. So since we're in the material world, we use whatever facilities of this world to serve Krishna. So using the facilities of the world, according to Shastra, is called piety, right? But we're using those facilities to please Krishna. But Krishna wrote the scriptures. Therefore, we do it according to the scriptures. So therefore, the devotees get confused. Either we're supposed to be pious, and then they get distracted by that, or we don't care for all this piety, and doing all this nice stuff is not necessary. You know what I'm saying? Does that make sense? You know, it's like the leader doesn't feel that he needs to be nice to anybody because we're just trying to do Krishna's service, and why can't people understand that? Why do they have to get so sentimental and absorbed in all that? So I'm a practical person. I don't get distracted by this, all these emotions. I just, you know, see the work, get it done. But that's against Shastra, that he's engaging himself in devotional service and trying to engage others. That part's correct. But that he's not considering others as individuals and their feelings and the situations that they're in, that's impious. That's why, at some point, he's not the temple president anymore. Right? Because after a while, the whole yatra doesn't like him. I mean, of course, he has his few friends, but, you know, he can sit with his few friends and complain how they kicked me out. I did so many years, I gave so much, you know, like this, you know. They don't appreciate, yeah. So it's like that. And so they also get that reaction, but the point is, does that make sense?
Yeah.
Is that where you're doing something right, you get the result there. Where you're doing something wrong, you get that result. This idea, this mundane idea that even if so much is right, if there's one fault, it's all bad. That's not real. You know what I'm saying? It's where it's wrong, that's where you get the bad result. Where you're right, that's where you get the good result. Does that make sense? Unless it's offensive, and then that can cut down on pious results. But sensual weakness, sensual attachment, then they're two separate things. You know what I'm saying? So that's why the person will be so attached to all sinful things and so very attached to devotional things. Because they're two separate things. You know, but if he offends devotees, that will start to reduce the one. You know? Does that make sense? So that's why these stories are always thrown in. Very rarely, but they're thrown in just to break this idea that, you know, if there's one bad thing, like let's say the person is example before, he's a manager, and he's always doing really good management. Then he makes one big mistake. Now, some people say, oh, he's not a manager. He never was a manager. No, he was always a manager. He still is. Just he made a mistake. Now, correct that mistake and go on managing. Does that make sense? But this modern idea, one thing's wrong, throw everything out. At what point do you run out of people? You know, or at what point do you run out of, you know, some standard like that?
That's why they don't have any philosophy.
Yeah, it's no philosophy, you know, you don't
there's
have...
nobody in the temple.
Yeah, you know, like that, or you don't have... yeah, so many things like that. Besides, when after practicing either yoga or meditation for some time, one imagines that I am Brahman, aham grahopasana. There is the maximum possibility of falling in the trap of impersonal spiritual jnana. That's what I said from the yoga. See, the situation of Paramatma doesn't have, it's not inherent in its own. It means it's a position, but when it comes to the end, you either have to choose moving forward to Bhagavat or moving back to Brahman. It's not that you stay there. Right? Brahman, you either move forward to the personal or fall back into the material. Does that make sense? So these all... In this process, realization of the eternal form of Bhagavan and the variegated characteristics of transcendence is not available. Right? So here, the variegated characteristics of transcendence. So all they're seeing is Paramatma, who's the Lord of controlling the material energy through his laws. That's what they're seeing. So that what he's controlling here is a reflection of the original transcendental, you know, culture and activities that the yogi doesn't see. Right? So the one just sees the energies and their potential of interaction. But the interaction isn't what's important. It's just the masculine and feminine principles, if they're on the impersonal. If they're Maya bodies, then they don't see anything. So, yeah. But it's not dynamic. It being dynamic, those interactions and you involved, right? In other words, Brahman means you're just an observer of it. But when you're involved, you're interacting with it. That means you're following the laws. It's controlled by Paramatma. Does it make sense? Now, if you're following those laws how they please the Lord, and then that takes on the bhakti, that takes on then you're dealing with Bhagavat. Right? So all three aspects are the same thing. Because the situation has its potential, has its laws that govern it, but there's the person in who you're involved in that situation and trying to get a result for. So therefore you can't separate them, but at the same time, they're three separate things. Does that make sense?
So Paramatma realization in essence, it's based on realization that even though it's permanent, if you take it forward to Bhagavan, but then it's lost at the moment and then it's took back to Bhagavan, so it's temporary.
It'll be temporary.
Realization, but even though it's there.
Yeah, it's temporary.
Yeah.
But it's like Brahman realization, it's also temporary. You either have to move forward to Bhagavat or it will move the other way. You The thing is neutral is neutral is a point of passing through, right? It's not an actual situation. So as we see, is that jiva is either under the influence of the internal potency or the external. There's not a category of jivas who are independently just not under either. There's no discussion of it at all. There's not one exemption. We're not one example. You understand? So that, because the marginal potency means it's by position the neutral state. Does that make sense? But the neutral state is not someplace you can stay. You either have to go this way or that way. You have, you know, in other words, you may be in a state, but you have to do something with it. So that means they're in the state of now seeing the Lord and them being there, but now they either have to surrender the Lord or think they're the Lord. You know? Or, I mean, they can't, of course, go back to material life. You know?
So when the soul is liberated in Brahman, he's still technically under the external energy.
No, he's in one sense he's potentially under the control because he sees Brahman, but Brahman realization doesn't get rid of that I am the controller and enjoyer. But you're inactive in controlling and enjoying. Therefore, there's no material reaction, so you're liberated. Does that make sense? But desire is inherent in the living entity, so as soon as you desire, then you have to control something. And since you don't know the spiritual, you don't know how to control within the spiritual environment, then you'll go back to the material environment.
So in that moment he's just in his marginal position, but...
Yeah, he's in the marginal position.
But he will again...
Yeah. That's why you'll see there's a difference in how we talk about the impersonal element. As a process, we say it's not of interest. Does that make sense? You know, especially Mayavad, there's nothing to gain there at all. You know. But when they're discussing spiritual situation, they're not saying that the being situated Brahman is bogus. They're just saying it's not the ultimate situation. Because one will be temporarily situated there. So one either should move forward or one will come back. And since you made all that endeavor to get to there, why not keep going? Does that make sense?
There's nothing holding you back.
I did. Maya's always got some new tricks, you know, so. You know, so it means after coming from Brahman, you come down as grass. So, you know, then you'll be happier as a blade of grass in the sun than one who's not. You know, so I'm sure that you're liberated. You will be in the sun and get nice water and everything. You probably less people will step on you, you know, stuff like that. Yes.
I'm just thinking of the example of the two birds in the tree. One is eating the fruit, and the super soul's just sitting there accompanying
yes.
The individual soul. So I was thinking that if the bird turns around to face, if the soul faces the super soul, so that would be paramatma realization. There either has to be interaction or they turn away and start eating the fruit again. It's not
yeah, basically.
Just like, okay, I'm looking at you.
Oh, hi.
So it has to either
nice
back to material or engage in a relationship.
Yeah, yeah, that would be good. That would be good. Okay. In this process, realization of the eternal form of Bhagavan and the variegated characteristics of transcendence is not available. The form which is imagined at the time of upasana, whether virat or the four-armed form situated in the heart, is not eternal. Although this process is superior to the cultivation of impersonal jnana, it is not the perfect and all-pleasing process. Right? So virat means you're seeing how Paramatma is controlling everything like this, or you're just seeing the person Paramatma. But the point is both of them are, how you say? I use the word? they're not an eternal situation. Because Paramatma, even though Vishnu is eternal, but he's expanded into your heart in this manifestation because you're in that, because you're in the material world. You leave the material world, he, you know, doesn't have to make that manifestation. Does that make sense? And Virat is also only manifest when the material creation is there. And it's always the manifestations of it are constantly changing. So they won't, that's why it said that Paramatma and Brahman realization are faculties of the material existence. Because in the spiritual world, no one is absorbed in Brahman or Paramatma. Everyone's absorbed in Bhagavan. There is no. So it's only a concept that is practiced here. It doesn't mean that Brahman and Paramatma is material. It just means it's a function that only happens here. Just like creation and destruction only happen here. They don't happen in the spiritual world. Right? It's not perfect and pleasing. So pleasing means there's a person. There's interaction, there's relationship. That will cause that pleasure, that happiness. The Siddhanta is that Paramatma Darshan cannot be called Shuddha Bhakti. In this regard, it is stated in Bhakti Sandarbha. After the creation of this universe, the expansion of the Supreme Lord, who enters it as the controller of the material nature, and who is situated as the maintainer of the creation, is known as Jarad Ishvara, or Paramatma. His function is related more to displaying the external potency rather than the internal potency. Therefore, this tattva is naturally inferior to supreme and eternal Bhagavat tattva. Paramatma himself is Bhagavan. But our understanding of him and his, therefore, interaction with us is on an inferior position than when he's acting as Vishnu. Does that make sense? So even though what's happening is he's interacting with his potencies, and so it's all going on through his yoga maya, but what is perceived is through the external energy. So the emphasis is on the control or displaying the material phenomena rather than the spiritual world. Makes sense.
For the devotee, in his heart, there is whole spiritual world.
How do you define devotee?
One who approaches Bhagavan with bhakti.
Okay. Is that okay? You don't have to worry. You don't have to get upset that there's a whole spiritual world there, you know, like this. You know, why do I have to carry this around on that? Why can't someone else do, you know? Okay? You're not worried about that. Which spiritual world? Am I being forced to carry around Vrindavan when actually I'd rather carry around Vaikuntha? Vaikuntha's a little smaller. You know, Goloka is 51% of the whole spiritual world, and so, you know, Vaikuntha's a lot smaller. No problem. Okay, good. Absolute truth realized exclusively through the process of bhakti is called Bhagavan. In Bhakti Sandarbha, the characteristics of Bhagavat Tattva are described as follows. The complete absolute truth endowed with all transcendental potencies is called Bhagavan. Right? So when there is not all transcendental potencies manifest, then you're not dealing with Bhagavan, you're dealing with Brahman or Paramatma. Right? And also is here, is if you're dealing with Paramatma or with Brahman, then bhakti is not exclusive. Right? There'll be something else. There'll be the bhakti and jnana. But those jnana and jnana are there because of our conditioning. We're not discussing it as a tool of using. Right? Because pure devotion will use the same tools, but it will be according to how do you say? It will start with the devotion to Krishna, so it's still exclusively bhakti. Does that make sense? We have to be able to discern where bhakti is pure, but endeavor means you have to use facilities. Right? The body, the mind, and words have to be engaged in certain situations to perform manifest a particular kind of devotion. Right? Does that make sense? You know, the service that goes with it. Someone who's performing mixed devotional service, maybe using the same situations, doing the same service, getting the same result, but it's mixed because of the consciousness. So it's not exclusive, that devotion. Does that make sense? There's also some other mix that, due to their conditioned nature, they like the jnana or they like the meditation. Or does that make sense?
So like the example you were using, that somebody who comes along to inspire you, but they're attached, they get less result than if they're just doing it genuinely.
Yeah, that would work. Or you have the thing where you have the person who likes to meditate, and then you offer them to do some service to Krishna, and don't bother them, they're meditating. You know, but they're supposed to be meditating on the Lord to, you know, and then, you know, as an aspect of service. Mm-hmm. So they're attached to the meditation and that peacefulness it gives, or all these different things like that. So it is connected, so therefore it's nice, but they're still attached to that element. That's why it's called mixed. So Bhagavan means it's exclusive. Does that make sense? Like that. So for the devotees who are worshipping Bhagavan, then it may be mixed, but their goal is exclusively Krishna and his pleasure. Like the devotees will all say that that's my goal, but I may not be there. But the yogi, his goal is actually some other things. Bhagavan, Brahman, there's some other goal.
So in Bhagavan, the mix or the traces are subsiding.
Yeah, they'll be subsiding. I mean, the other, they'll subside to a particular point, but at some point you'll be left with these elements because they're not dealing with the Lord on a platform that would require them to not be there.
They're not really trying to get rid of it.
No, up to a point. Mm. They're trying to get rid of whatever will get in the way of getting to the point they want to get to. Like that. Like to get to Brahman, there's no discussion of getting rid of the concept that I'm the controller and enjoyer. Right? Because when they say Brahmananda, what's the essence of that?
Ananda.
Ananda. And?
Brahman.
And what does that mean?
Eternity.
Eternity, but... In why are they inspired to get Brahman? You're the greatest. You're Brahman. You're God. So you're the supreme controller and therefore the supreme enjoyer. So they don't get rid of that. That's why they can never actually enter the spiritual world. Bhagavan appears as Brahman and Paramatma. Hence, he is the original tattva and the supreme absolute truth. His Swarup Vigraha is transcendental. The complete spiritual bliss resides in him. His potencies are inconceivable and beyond any reasoning. He cannot be fathomed by any process fabricated by the knowledge of the infinitesimal jiva. It's interesting, and here he just... we'll see these things, but he just mentioned those three from the Tattva Sutras. You know, he's the absolute truth. He's the master of all energies, and he's the Lord of Rasa. So then here they're saying is that he is complete spiritual bliss resides in him. So that means the complete manifestation of Rasa. Potencies are inconceivable beyond any reasoning. Right? And he is the original tattva and the supreme absolute truth. So they mention all of that. All of
so these are the three of the Dasa Mula related
yeah.
to the Lord.
Yeah. So you see, this is always a consistency in presentation. So here we'll just read through it, but why it means so much is because it's according to those. the process of jnana and karma are incapable of approaching Bhagavan. By combining Bhagavat Tattva with jnana, the Tattva appears as the formless and the effulgent impersonal Brahman. And if he is seen through the yoga process, he appears as Paramatma, invested with this material creation. Bhakti is supremely pure. It is very painful for Bhakti Devi to see the Supreme Personality of Godhead in his lesser manifestations. If she sees this anywhere, she cannot tolerate it. So now we're adding in another element that it's not just us whimsically whenever we decide to, you know, what to do and this and that. Then Bhakti Devi herself is there as a personality and may appreciate or not our lack of seeing the importance of being sincere. Yes. Basically, the result is one doesn't get realization. Because when activity or chit is combined with ladini, or results that are for the Lord's pleasure, that's called bhakti. When that happens, then the sundini potency then creates realization. So one progresses. So if Bhakti Devi is not pleased, what means in that to that degree, then one wouldn't progress. Right? So in other words, the aspects that are okay, that one progresses. The ones that aren't, then one wouldn't progress.
So it seems like she keeps her distance. So.
Yeah, means she would, yeah, that's right. Basically, that's why it said this here. He cannot be fathomed by any process fabricated by the knowledge of the infinitesimal jiva. The processes of jnana and karma incapable of approaching Bhagavan. So if they're there, it just means it gets in the way of one's approaching the Lord and understanding the Lord. But one has to understand is that it's the jiva's choice. You know, this idea that there's somebody there who's going to get angry and come and, you know, how do you say? Yeah, what's if they're old and sought. You know, they say, sought him down with a thunderbolt or, you know, some. You understand? In other words, there's no revenge. So this idea that there's a, you know, vengeful persons that if you do something wrong, no, it's your choice, you just get the reaction, it's a science. You don't get involved, she doesn't get involved. You get involved, she reciprocates. Is that okay? So you don't have to worry Bhakti Devi sitting there.
Short smite.
Yeah, smite. One of these three manifestations of the Absolute Truth is only the manifestation of Bhagavan's personal form that is the object of bhakti. Oh, did I read that right? Yeah, out of these three manifestations of the Absolute Truth, it is only the manifestation of Bhagavan's personal form that is the object of bhakti. So the other two aren't objects of bhakti. One is going through stages of realization, but you're doing them in connection with Bhagavan. Does that make sense? So when the devotee's understanding the Brahman platform, he's doing it through his service to Bhagavan. Right? Or he understands that Krishna is controlling everything. He does that as Paramatma. You know? Or the element of Virat. So then that's also Paramatma. Does that make sense? But it's the progress is there because of the desire for the devotion to Bhagavan. That makes sense? Therefore, one's called a devotee, a bhakta. But the person who's not seeing it like that, they're only following that process to get up to, you know, the yoga realization or Brahman realization, then they're called impersonalists or yogis. Does that make sense? That's the difference. But even within Bhagavan's personal manifestation, there's one important distinction. Where the internal potency displays its complete opulence, Aishvarya, there Bhagavan appears as Vaikunthanath Narayana. And where the internal potency displays its supreme sweetness, Madhurya, there Bhagavan appears as Sri Krishna. In spite of being predominant almost everywhere, Aishvarya loses its charm in the presence of Madhurya. In the material world, Aishvarya is more influential than Madhurya. But in the spiritual world, it is completely the opposite. Although from the viewpoint of Siddhanta, Narayana and Krishna are non-different, Krishna is superior due to possessing more rasa. Right? So we've established Bhagavan Paramatma, Brahman Paramatma, then Bhagavan. And now within Bhagavan, that based on Aishwarya, that based on Madhurya. So Krishna is superior because of the element of the greater aspect of rasa. Right? Tattva-wise, there's non-difference. That's why the example is given of a candle. One candle lights many candles. There's no difference. But still, there's the original candle. So that manifests more rasa because of the sweetness. Right? Yes?
Krishna manifests his form accordingly to his potency?
Yes. Because it's through potency that there's manifestation. He manifests through his yoga maya.
His qualities manifest through activities.
No, his qualities manifest through... you can say that, but the area that the qualities would be manifest is based on the mood of the devotee. Does that make sense? So it's still the devotees are his potency. So you can say he's manifest through his potency. But the point is what particular manifestation depends upon the devotee and what devotee and the mood of the devotee. So in the spiritual, we're seeing here the spiritual world, the mood is more important. Here, someone deals very nicely and everything like that, then you have a great relationship, but you may not consider it as important as something else that could further your material facility. Does that make sense? It doesn't seem to be. Huh? Well, here it says no battery. Yeah. Yes.
This one got
that one's full, and this one has no battery.
This one, it's okay.
Oh, okay. That one's serious. Yeah. So there may be the tendency to develop one's opulence at the expense of the taste of relationships, right? Especially the modern culture, professes that as a great, noble deed, right? But unfortunately, in the spiritual world, it's the opposite.
I could say that Krishna is attracted to his Vladimir. So to the extent that his Vladimir Shakti comes around, and we present the Vladimir, we assist in that service, then Bhakti Devi would review what Krishna is intending.
Yes, because Bhakti is a combination of chit and vladi. So in other words, with activities being done for Krishna's pleasure, that's bhakti. Right? But it won't be manifest except through the activity. That's why it's being said that the activity is the central point. Like that, because that manifests the mood. The mood has to be there, but if the mood's there and there's no activity, it's useless. Of course, since there's activity, no mood, but we've already established the mood is proper. But it manifests to just say, I have the mood and that's good enough. You know, it's like a had one godbrother in Vrindavan, very famous when Prabhupada was there. Prabhupada in the morning would walk around the deities, you know, walk around the temple in the morning. So this devotee would walk in front, he would walk in front of Prabhupada, facing Prabhupada, so he's walking backwards, you know, with his hands folded and you know, always glorifying Prabhupada. So in that way he was, you know, very unique, very special, because I don't know that anybody else would so blatantly in any situation glorify Prabhupada, but he was bold enough to do it. So he would be walking there, and they're walking around, oh Prabhupada, you're the greatest, you're this and that, you know, I only want to serve and this and that and so on like that. So then Prabhupada says, so then, you know, clean up this water puddle, you know. And then Prabhupada keeps on walking. You know, in other words, there's a limit to just saying everything's wonderful and that you want to serve, but not manifesting the service. Does that make sense? So to have that manobhav but not apply it through service, that's limited in its pleasure to Krishna. Right? So that's why bhakti is the combination of endeavor with the desire to, you know, please Krishna.
Otherwise, it would just be
Shantarasmaya. If you're just appreciating, then it's Shanta. But there is no activity.
Yeah.
You know, I'm saying the only activity is the appreciation. That's why neutrality is limited.
But the body isn't Shantaras, like the animals, it's really.
Yeah, but it's
do something.
But what are they doing? What are they doing?
Increasing the environment.
Increasing the environment. That's the point. It's not the central point. They're enhancing the environment like that. So in other words, they appreciate the quality of Krishna, so they enhance the environment in which that quality can manifest, but they're not actually involved in that process.
Can we say they're just predominantly in Shantaras, but it's purely in Shantaras in the spiritual world?
Are they predominantly, it means, what's the percentage you want to use here?
Well, I'm just saying that,
you know what I'm saying, is that
does something for Krishna in the spiritual world one way or another. I mean, there's always an element of dasya for someone who's part of the rest.
So since everybody's doing that, what would you call someone who all they're doing is only that? In other words, since there's activity, but the activity is not being done in servitorship, it's not being done in friendship, it's not being done in parental, it's not being done in conjugal, what would you call that activity?
It's a trick question. Shanta?
No, it's only a trick question because you're trying to create a trick question. You know what I'm saying? In other words, we'll say this is a brick, it's made out of dirt, but there's a lot of air in here. So, you know what I'm saying? But do we worry about the air?
No.
No. So, the point is not the endeavor there, it's the nature of the result that they want. Right? The endeavor has to be made to create a result for Krishna. That's what the endeavor is doing. Right? What result do they want for Krishna? They're not trying to please him as a servant or a friend or anything. They're just trying to create a nice atmosphere in which that quality that they appreciate in Krishna, they can appreciate. Right? So, in other words, so that's why when you're dealing with the tattva or the siddhanta of bhakti, it's counted as a rasa. But when they're dealing with actually Vrindavan, it's actually dropped as a rasa. It's not counted, it's just environment. Does that make sense?
I think you were mentioning that the jivas do not take this position. These positions are manifested directly from the...
They could take, but generally speaking, they don't. I mean, the four kumaras, their service is neutral. their neutrality. So they appreciate and they'll glorify and they'll, you know, like that. But the point is when you're talking about unlimited, then it's not considered very much. You know, if I have a drop of water here and we're standing next to the ocean, and then I keep bringing it back to, no, but it's a drop of water, has all the difficulties, no, it's a drop of water. No, but this is big and great and all that. No, but this is also ocean, but it's a very small ocean. In fact, if we, you know, brought along the whose, then, you know, it would be pretty big. You know, like that. But, you know, no, but this is, you know what I'm saying? It's not, does that make sense? So, in other words, what's happened in here is that we've taken the word that's being used as a medium to define something else. In other words, we were discussing the Hladini, Shakti, and Bhakti. And so we're showing that Bhakti's manifest through the endeavor. It wasn't actually a discussion about endeavor. Does that make sense? So now you've taken that word endeavor and now changed the presentation. Does that make sense? So that's why it looks confusing. But it's actually two different discussions. What do I say? Because the point is, Hladini means the result. And so it's not a result of pleasing Krishna through the conjugal or the friendship or these others. It's a point of pleasing Krishna by appreciating his qualities. That's why it's neutral. Because you're appreciating the qualities, but you're not interacting specifically with those qualities. You know what I'm saying? It's your interaction is to appreciate the quality. You know, but because it's an interaction with Krishna, therefore it's appreciated. So it's counted as bhakti. Does that make sense? Like that, yeah. So the point is it's always on the goal. You know, what's your situation? What's the goal? Those two are connected through activity. That's why activity is the central point. But the activity is based on what is your identity and what is your goal.
So even though they're Shankara, they act.
Yeah, they may act. Four Kumaras walk around, you know, like that. Does that make sense? But they're just appreciating the greatness of Vishnu or, you know, some aspect like that, and that's all. So that is their service, just appreciating that. And the Lord reciprocates on that platform. But it's not dynamic, right? Because there's no technically service rendered, meaning the senses are engaged in a way to bring about pleasure for Krishna's senses. Here, you with the mind, which is in one sense a sense, but you're only appreciating. So how is it bringing about specifically a pleasure to Krishna's senses? You know what I'm saying? Because if it was the mind itself, just on its own, was the best, why would you go through all the trouble for the mind to engage the senses to get, you know, and adjust the whole situation so that you can get something, so you can get a taste out of it? Does that make sense? Like that. So it's the mind doesn't consider it enough to just think about something. It wants the senses to engage in the activity to get the experience. But thinking about it also is nice. So that's Shantaras, is thinking about it. So it's nice. But it's not as nice as servitorship where the senses are engaged. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Yeah. So it's always active. It's always active. Yeah.
So Shanta Rasa is a temporary rasa?
No, it's a permanent rasa.
It would seem like you would develop the need to act if this.
No, not necessarily. By association, one might see the what more is there, how more he could please, and might take that up.
Because I'm thinking, feeling, willing.
But the point is what we were discussing before, is that generally the Shanta Ras that we see is not necessarily jivas.
Okay.
You know what I'm saying? There may be some there, but yeah. it's not... It's not the category that's generally seen as Jiva's get involved in it. Like that. Yes.
Some bit.
It's Sandini. The jivas are some bit. That's why it's not you know the general. So they'll get involved in the through the Hladini Shakti. Right? So they'll be under that in the fire of the Hladini Shakti. And that way then be appreciating Krishna's existence. You know, so this interaction will be there. But one won't generally put oneself under the existence potency. Because then it's just your, you know, existence. You know what I'm saying? When two things are the same, there's not as much appreciation as when they're different. It'll be more dynamic. So then the eternity and the bliss then are connected. It's more dynamic, connected through activity. So we can assist in the activity. You know, we're not Krishna, and we're not the internal potency. But the activity brings the two together, and we're from that potency that generates activity. So therefore, that's the natural place for us to assist. So being active is more natural for us.
Vrindavan goes living into this by the importance of incense, or the importance of, like, for example, the bumblebees who are glorifying Krishna, or the smart fish birds who are like messengers between Radha and Krishna. They are serving this food. Then, obviously,
Shanta. That's what we've been discussing. The Shanta Ras. They enhance the environment. Like that. Anything? Because Yoga Maya, she creates the environment. Understand? Then the devotees do something with that environment. So the environment means what you can perceive, what opportunities are there, where you fit into that environment. You know, the inspiration, all these different things. That's all Yoga Maya. Does that make sense? Thus, it has been established that the favorable cultivation of activities meant to please Krishna is the sole intrinsic characteristic, Swarup Lakshana of bhakti. Right? So that's the point. He's trying to establish this, that a favorable cultivation of activities, right, meant to please Krishna, that's the intrinsic characteristic of bhakti. That won't change. Other characteristics you may manifest or not, but that one won't change. Yes?
Also, we can connect, like, this process to Jnana from 18th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, the object of knowledge. The process reveals the object.
Well, here is object of knowledge. But it's not that Krishna is the object. You know, it's object of knowledge, because knowledge is the feminine aspect. So knowledge is actually the object. You know what I'm saying? So knowledge and Krishna will interact. We can assist knowledge. And there's always that aspect. So we perceive things from the side of object. You know, was he discussing padartha, right? Because we're padartha, so we can see through padartha, like that. Because we're infinitesimal, how much we'll see, but the internal potency is unlimited. That means then the unlimited qualities of Krishna can be appreciated by the limited jiva if they connect themselves through the unlimited internal potency. Does that make sense? So. The actual what's going on is Krishna's interacting with his internal potency, right? So, you know, he is tattva, and his internal potency is the padartha. We can assist, right? So in this way, we become padartha. Does that make sense? But we're always going to see it from this side. because that's where we're situated. Is that okay? To remain both devoid of desires, separate from the desire to please Krishna, anyavilashita, and free from the coverings of karma, jnana karma, jnana karma dhyanavaditam, is the tatastha lakshana, or secondary characteristic of bhakti. Right? So the swarup is the cultivation of favorable activities, right? Not the avoiding any desire separate from pleasing Krishna and karma and jnana, right? Because if those were swarup lakshanas, the problem is how would we take up devotional service? We couldn't. But that one's favorably cultivating activities meant to please Krishna, meant to please, whether we're pleasing or not, that we can do. Therefore, bhakti is there. But it's impure because we may have desires that are separate from the desire to please Krishna, and there may be karma and jnana mixed. Does that make sense? So that would be probably why also. Yeah, okay. Vishnu Bhakti Pravakshami Yaya Sarvam Avapyate. In this half verse from Bhakti Sandarbha, the secondary characteristics of bhakti are reviewed. The word abhilasita means that apart from the desire to attain love of God. All other types of desire should be rejected. There are two types of separate desires. The desire for sense gratification, bhukti, and the desire for liberation, mukti. In Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, 1.2.22, Srila Rupa Goswami writes that as long as the two witches of the desires for bhukti and mukti remain in the devotee's heart, not even a fraction of pure happiness derived from Sarup's siddha bhakti will arise. Right? So we'll think, well, that means we'll get nothing. It means not even a fraction of what's actually available. Remember, Taittiriya Upanishad, when it's discussing ananda, then it gives the example, it starts off to, you know, just to quantify that if you have a king, you know, like Yudhishthira Maharaj, who is unrivaled rule emperorship of the world, and everything's running smoothly in his kingdom, that's considered one unit of happiness. Right, so we're not even dealing with a fraction of a unit of one happiness here. You know, does that make sense? And then that times 100 is what your general Gandharvas. That times 100 are your it means you have your oh excuse me no that's the Pitris. 100 times that are the Deva Gandharvas, 100 times that are the Brahma Gandharvas, right? The Gandharvas that sing for Brahma. 100 times that are the, you know, your residents of the heavenly planets. 100 times that are the authorities of the heavenly planets. 100 times that is Indra. 100 times that is Bhrigu. 100 times that's the Prajapatis. 100 times that's Brahma. And unlimitedly greater than that is the happiness of being liberated, right? And liberation is compared to a fraction of a portion of a drop compared to the unlimited ocean of bhakti. So when I say here a fraction, yeah. And so you're getting some happiness from it, but what actually is there, because we're comparing this happiness with something else I was doing. You know, we went on vacation, it was great, and we went to the temple and it was great, and kind of looking at him that, you know, this one was a little more than that one. So it was only a little more, it should be like unlimitedly more. So what's blocking it is these two witches, bhukti and mukti. Yes. You want to know if therefore we have some connection with the from the Celts and all that, because they were into this and they accepted the witches and all that. So you want to know if there's some connection of the Wiccans here, and then therefore should we be going for the, you know, the Stonehenge festival and all that, because there is a connection here. Is they're into witches and we're also into not being into witches, and so
next week.
Next week? Oh yeah, that's true. That's true. Yeah, that's at Glastonbury, right?
Yeah.
How can we get into
these
witches?
It's burning.
Okay. That might work. I think there's some Spanish blood here somewhere. It has worked in the past. Yes, I think that's. Basically, it's just transferring the desire to serving Krishna, because when one tastes a higher taste, the lower taste is given up. Right? So, in other words, what's being given up here is a direct endeavor within the material sphere. That's bhakti. And being situated neutrally and not taking up service to Krishna, that's mukti. Right? So that's why these two are discussed, because these are the two situations that the living entity tends to take up. You know, the devotees will be distracted by that, or it's like, you know, I want to get out of the material world, it's so painful, but that's mukti. You know what I'm saying? It's the point is we want to serve Krishna, so whether we're here or in the spiritual world doesn't really matter. Yeah. Does that make sense? So that higher taste, by continually in the association of the devotees, those who have more taste than us, that's why you associate with those more advanced, is that then we take on their mood or quality that removes these two. Right? You know, someone's willing to take so much, go through so much trouble for Krishna, then that, you know, breaks down our desire for mukti, you know, or that they see that the devotional activity is so much nicer than, you know, other activities, that it breaks down the bhakti. You know, so by association, by practice, and then, you know, by chanting, all these things wear it down. But in other words, it comes to the point, we have to make that decision to be involved in that process. But it gets whittled down to the point that at one point it's easy to step over. You know, it's like the ocean becomes reduced down to the size of a cat's hoofprint, so you can just step over it, but you have to step over it. It's not that, wow, hey, check it out, it's only the size of a cat's hoofprint, that's neat. You know, no, you have to step over it. Is that okay?
Another question arises from the discussion of this. As devotees, can we get to the situation of thinking that because there was trouble in the situation, so I just stay out and not get really involved, because like that was...
Yeah, that's the mode of goodness. The mode of goodness, the tendency is not get involved in anything that's a problem, which is favorable as long as one is, because of situation and goodness, one is choosing a brahminical situation for oneself. In other words, not getting involved in your business or big administration or that. It means they're not big trouble, but they're also not your nature to do anyway. Right? Does that make sense? You know, so, but within the brahminical field, and specifically in the brahminical field of studying, teaching, and, you know, all these activities that we're given, to not want to get involved in that because it's trouble, then that's where the mode of goodness loses its usefulness. Because then there's, you don't want trouble, so then that's the mukti. So then that's not pure goodness. Because pure goodness means you're not worried about the bhakti and mukti. Right? Does that make sense? Like that. So so it's useful in that you're not in passion and ignorance, but it's still not good enough, because pure goodness is the ideal or the proper. Is that okay?
The other question was contrasting this element which you can put here, pure devotional service, with the yoga ladder presented in the deeper.
Okay. Yeah.
So the focus now is changing dimension, right? So get into the line of getting away from the material attachments, appreciating the qualities of the spiritual qualities. So the spiritual activities. Mm-hmm. So this would be like getting lower, so it would be let them go.
Yeah, one would let them go. In other words, the engagement of karma wouldn't be so important because that would be reduced down to a minimal. Or even if it's not, one is still, one gets realization earlier, and one is still absorbed in the activities. But the results of those activities and then giving them to Krishna is what's important. It's doing that, doing your activities for Krishna, rather than doing them and then giving the result to Krishna. So in other words, the activity won't change, but the mentality changes from renunciation to sannyas. Does that make sense? 18th chapter, I think it's verse 1? 18th chapter. Krishna then opens the chapter defining that renunciation means giving up the results of your endeavor. And sannyas means not doing an activity that will give you result. Right? So the Mayavadis mean I don't do any activity at all because that gives material. What he means there is that you're not doing an activity that will get you a result. You're doing an activity that only get Krishna a result. So that's how then the devotee works even harder for Krishna than he would for himself. So Prabhupada is saying at least we should work equally. We should be working as at least as hard as the karmis. Right? But ideally better, but at least as hard as the karmas. You know, they have that conviction to please themselves, so we have that conviction to please Krishna. So that's why then we'd be more expert at it. But the problem is we go to the karmas for becoming expert. And what is the main thing that, what are the main tools that they give for self-help? Yeah, your goals, your mood, your identity. So they're all material. So there's not, they're not actually getting the essence of the workings of prosperity. They're having that, what's getting in your way is you don't have the right attitude to be prosperous. And you're not contemplating your prosperity. You know, your prosperity doesn't mean enough to you. Therefore, you haven't, you know, fixed a specific goal. You haven't prioritized. You know, you let it all just attack you at once. And so then, you know, of course, there's the enjoyment of thinking about all these things, but if you actually want them, then you have to prioritize. But it's still yourself, your mood, yourself, your results. So it's not actually a very viable method. You know what I'm saying? Because sannyas, renunciation means, okay, you're doing it, but it's yours. But that's not pure bhakti. But sannyas means it's Krishna's. You're just working for Krishna. So then it becomes, that would be your proper situation. Does that make sense? Yeah. Both bodily and mental enjoyments are considered bhukti. To make an extraneous effort to remain free of disease, to desire palatable foodstuffs, fame and power, wealth, followers, wife, sons and daughters, fame and victory are all considered bhukti. To desire to take one's next birth in a Brahmin family or in a royal family, to attain residence on the heavenly planets or in Brahmaloka, or to attain any other type of happiness in one's next life is also considered bhukti. Practice of the Eightfold Yoga System and to desire the eight or 18 varieties of mystic perfections is also categorized as bhukti. To attain Shuddha Bhakti, one has to remain completely aloof from the desire for bhukti. Right? So in other words, anything outside of just wanting to please Krishna is, you know, basically useless. Yes?
What if one is not explicitly desiring them, but still thinks there's some value in it? Is that what you're talking
about? Then you're dealing with it's still bhukti, it's still a problem, but it'll be in a more pure state. So it will give a higher situation. Does that make sense? So, means the principle of it. So it's still the, means it's not strongly manifest as the secondary aspect of weakness of heart, right? The primary being control and enjoy. Secondary meaning that there's a specific area of controlling and enjoying that you are attached to. And that will naturally give rise to, what do you call it? Asat Krishna, right? It means the taste for material enjoyment, right? So there's one thing is that you have an attachment to, like endeavoring in a certain way because you'll be happy, but it doesn't mean that you have ever become happy, you just have the idea you will be. Asat Krishna means you actually have a taste for that specific one. So you are able to accomplish it. You know what I'm saying? So you move back from that, and it's not specifically that you have a dynamic idea to endeavor for happiness in that way. But it still is seen as a nice way. So, in other words, the second level of that attachment is getting less, but it's still there. You know, so it should be worked on. Generally, if it's to that, then you would just intellectually deal with it through the philosophy. If it's actually that there's a need for it, then one would take it and connect it to Krishna so it gets purified. And by that purification, it reduces the attachment, yeah, the need to be involved, you know, which will bring it then to that intellectual point that you have to get rid of it at some point. You know, is that something? Merely going to reside in the forest or accepting the dress of a sannyasi will not free one from the desire for bhakti. If bhakti resides in the devotee's heart, then even while living amidst the objects of the senses, he will be able to remain detached from them and will be capable of abandoning the desire for bhakti. When a jiva develops a taste for Krishna bhajan, his attachment for the sense object starts fading. Right, so this was just the answer to Mataji's question. Is that... as you associate with the process and the devotees, then getting a taste for the devotional, you'll lose the taste for it. Because bhakti means you have a taste for the material. So when you get a taste for the spiritual, naturally then the material taste goes, reduces. Yes?
When you say that bhakti and bhakti are not coexisting, it means that it's not coexisting simultaneously, but in more broad time.
No, but it means one is there and then the other. But the point is while they're absorbed in material facilities, then that bhakti is not manifest. Right? When they're absorbed in bhakti, then there's no bhakti manifest.
And
Yeah, but then at that point, the bhakti is not the prominent element. Is it?
Yes, but before he tasted the Shuddha Bhakti, he was on the Bhagavad.
But it's by association. By association, you take it up. You know what I'm saying? In other words, the others are there and they're happy, so you want to become like that. Yeah, but not even a fraction of pure. But so it's smaller than a fraction.
So bhava is not considered
a fraction of pure. Bhava is a fraction, yeah.
It's not bhava, it's here. Okay.
No, they're talking here. It means otherwise they're discussing for us. So we're functioning a little bit below the platform of bhava. Right, but does that make sense? So bhava is that drop. Prema is the unlimited ocean.
I asked positive, because this is efforts of very elevated devotees who still have some habits or desires.
But you're not seeing the chronology. Bilvamangal Thakur is, you know, avidly engaged in his pursuits. But when it's pointed out to him that if he made the same endeavor, you know, to realize God, he'd be very advanced. So being intelligent, then he took up the process. Right? So now he's reduced less of that.
But afterwards, when he traveled to Vrindavan, he again fall in this situation.
One could say yes, but
he didn't fall. He just looked at it.
That's not even point matters. Like whether one looks at an illusion or one's interacting with an illusion. What's the big deal? You know what I'm saying? We give illusion too much credit, because for us, illusion's reality. So that's why when we have to know the person fell down, well, how much? So we know how bad. It doesn't matter whether it's a little or a lot. It's the same illusion. But because we value that illusion, though we're dealing with it in the opposite, in repulsion instead of in that attraction. So therefore, we take it very seriously. But you know, in the Bhagavatam and like this, it'll say, you know, he saw the girl and he became attracted, and then he fell down. Right? It doesn't say anything more. Right? But if you go into some of these other literatures, Mahabharata, it'll give you so much more detail. You know what I'm saying? Because the audience is different. So the point is it doesn't matter. So we're not trying to protect him by saying, well, he only looked. You know, it means whether he looked or he went far, it doesn't matter. But the point is that before he was committed to associating with a prostitute. You know what I'm saying? You know, we're talking here, it's a lifestyle. We're not talking about going out and they light a cigarette and say, when the cigarette's out, your time's up. We're talking about people where they live a lifestyle together. The cultural aspect of the masculine and femininity and all this interaction. So he's committed to that as a lifestyle. Does that make sense? So, therefore, if he looks at someone's wife, one wouldn't compare the two. It's in the same category, but it's not in the same intensity, just saying, oh, well, he fell down again. It's slightly different. You understand? But the point is it also establishes the point, is that when one comes to be fully absorbed in devotional service, that doesn't come up again, because do you hear of another time of Bilvamangal getting distracted? Is there another one? Huh? You haven't heard, but you're leaving the door open that there's a possibility. Maybe. So you're taking it that this is a theorem, that it is, we haven't come up with an evidence that it has happened, but the possibility is there.
Maybe we should investigate.
You know, there's a lot of people in the Bhagavatam that wouldn't make it in our society. Okay? You understand? In other words, after that incident, and then he becomes more advanced and more committed, then you don't hear of anything happening again. Ajamil. Now, he was, if you think Bilvamangal was bad, then you have Ajamil. Right? Now, once he takes up very seriously again the devotional process, do we hear of another problem? You haven't heard. I see.
Maybe we should check Mahabharata.
So then, and Bharat Maharaj, after he's a deer, do we hear of any more problems in the Bhagavatam? Yes, no?
No.
No, okay. Good. Solid, conclusive. So therefore it still proves what we're talking about here. As the process goes, the more one is committed to it, the more taste one gets, and then that taste, it removes the material. It's just like this. Let us say, we have something we do, and it gives us some pleasure. Now, if there's something else we do, and it's just a fraction more pleasure, which are we going to choose?
The next one.
Right? The one that gives that little bit more pleasure. So it doesn't take a lot. So we're talking in, you know, like, you know, probably whatever's beyond nanometers, right? You know, smaller than that of, you know, happiness. And so, you know, we're getting a few more in the devotional, but it's real, it's spiritual. It's more than the material, so we're taking it. Does that make sense? Yeah. So it's not contradictory. Okay? Okay.
And in the case of Lord Maharaj, he was free from this desire of mukti and mukti because they came to heaven. And also he didn't have...
Nobody can hear.
Sorry. In the case of Bharat Maharaj, he was freed from the desires of bhakti and mukti because he became Baba, and also he didn't have a bad association. So what was the nature of his attachment to this deer? I mean, how did he do?
Didn't we already discuss that?
No, we didn't.
I thought we did. Maybe it was a few years ago. See, now he's going to be seeing, when he sees the deer, what does he see? If we're taking him on the transcendental platform.
Spirit soul.
Okay. And the spirit soul is in what form? Or what conditioning?
Deer.
Okay. And what kind of deer? A helpless baby deer. Now a soul that is conditioned as a helpless baby deer, what's it looking for?
Shelter.
Okay, so then naturally, as a compassionate devotee, because he sees the deer as a devotee of Krishna, but they don't know they're a devotee of Krishna. They just see themselves as this deer. So then he takes care. You know what I'm saying? He's not going, oh, it's so cute and fuzzy, and, you know, can I have it, mommy? Not like that. Does that make sense? So, he's still, when he's going out looking for the deer, he knows that there's a storm and the deer's not that big, so he'll get scared, so he's trying to go and find him. So he's still working on the transcendental platform, but at the time of death, he's thinking about that deer, even though he's thinking about it transcendentally, but he's still thinking about the deer. It's not connected there so directly to Krishna, so therefore...
That's why he's born...
Yeah, so he's born as a deer, but because he's on the transcendental platform, he's still... maintains his consciousness. Right? Because otherwise, if he's just attached to the deer, he'd be born as a deer with a deer consciousness. Does that make sense?
Yeah. And this idea that saving others, you know, children, saving others is more important than one's self-realization. By this example, in this case, it's called Bhagavad.
The point is that you can't help others if you're not helping yourself. If you're drowning in the ocean, how many people can you save?
Merely one.
Hmm?
Merely one.
I said you're drowning.
No one.
Right. So, this whole idea is that you'll just perform your service at a jeopardy and then in this way go away and like that, or we, you know, deal with the brahmacharis like cannon fodder, and so okay, yeah, we lose a few, but you know, we, you know, did this big festival, you know, that's not the system. But the point being made here with Bharat Maharaj is that the exclusivity of thinking of being absorbed in Krishna, that has to be what it is. There can't be these side distractions. It doesn't mean that he just mentioned someone who's situated like this can move in the world, right, and not be distracted. So they're pointing out, even on that level, if you're distracted, you'll still get it. It'll still create a problem. Right? Until you get to prema, then there'll be no problem.
Right?
Yes. Yeah, that's true. That's true. Yeah, because he was alone. There was no one else there. Like we see as a deer, then he'd always go and stay at around the ashrams. But there he wasn't. You don't hear at least much about it. So if there's other association, then... Is that okay? So, Andrew.
Om Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.
Jai Srila Prabhupada ki, Jai Samavita Bhaktivinoda ki, Jai Nitai Gaurabhai.